Hello and welcome to the Risk Map podcast for the second half of July 2015. The Risk Map podcast is produced by Control Risks, the global business risk consultancy. In London, I'm Jonathan Wood, Associate Director for Global Issues Analysis.
And in Singapore, I'm Angela Mancini, Managing Director for Global Client Services. Welcome to the podcast. In this edition, we'll take you, just virtually, unfortunately, to Hawaii, where ministers from a dozen different nations will hold another round of talks on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We'll also look at two landmark U.S.-Africa events, one in Washington, D.C., and the other on Africa's East Coast. But first, let's go to the middle of the Pacific Oceans for a fresh series of talks on the TPP. This has also been the topic of previous podcasts. Jonathan, what are the prospects right now for TPP in the U.S.?
Well, the prospects for TPP at the moment are actually quite good, and the main reason for this is that in mid-June, the U.S. Congress, after a fairly difficult debate, decided to give President Obama fast-track or trade promotion authority to actually negotiate the agreement. And this means that when the agreement is negotiated, it will be submitted for approval to Congress without the ability to add or amend the agreement. And this was a key demand of many of the Asian negotiating partners, particularly Japan. So it means that not only will the international negotiations be easier, but it also means that approval of the agreement in the U.S. will be easier as well.
And does it matter that China's not currently involved?
Well, it's a very interesting dynamic with China's involvement or lack thereof with the TPP. It was deliberately and quite conspicuously excluded as economies in the Asia-Pacific region on both sides of the Pacific began crafting the agreement several years ago. The thinking behind this was that TPP was meant to set rules around market access, around trade liberalization that might be difficult for China to join. The U.S. and other countries have expressed an interest that China joins at some point in the future, but there's very clearly a desire to determine what the ground rules will be without China's input.
And what is TPP trying to achieve overall?
In the broader, in the kind of, you know, very technical sense, what it's trying to achieve is increased market access among the countries around the Pacific Rim, especially in some protected sectors like agriculture. More kind of strategically, what TPP is trying to achieve is improve trade integration between some of the major free market economies around the Pacific Rim region. There is a concern, and just referring back to China again, in some Chinese policy circles, they see TPP as an effort to contain China's economic growth in the Asia region. And there may be some element strategically that some of the players in TPP see it as a hedge against what is quickly becoming the world's largest economy. But overall, the main goal is to set rules around trade, global trade in particular, that promote foreign investment, that promote standardization. And that's really the long-term objective. And the U.S. is quite keen to do this while it still has outsized influence in both the global and Asia-Pacific regional economies.
And assuming it's passed, how will TPP actually impact global trade negotiations?
Well, so what's interesting about TPP and a related trade agreement that the U.S. is negotiating with the EU, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, what we've seen over the last few years is that as global trade negotiations under the auspices of the World Trade Organization, or WTO, the so-called Doha Round, have stagnated because it's very difficult to get every country in the world, and especially major emerging markets, to agree on trade policies, we've seen those global negotiations be substituted by regional trade agreements, of which TPP is one, TTIP is one. A range of bilateral free trade agreements between major economies or major economic blocs. And of course, China and the other BRIC economies are doing their own thing within the context of the BRIC summit. These regional trade agreements have really taken the place of global trade negotiations for the time being. And unless there is significant progress within the Doha round, which doesn't seem likely in the near future, we are looking at a global trade environment where bilateral and regional trade relations are becoming more important than the global trade agenda and global trade harmonization. And that's quite an interesting and significant shift from the last 20 years of globalization, when global standards around trade were what drove the emergence of emerging economies in the first place.
Jonathan, many thanks. In the next 2 weeks, we'll see one African president come to Washington and then see the American president head to Ethiopia and Kenya. Each of these meetings has symbolic and practical implications.
That's right, Angela. And to get an overview of these two important trips, Chuck Hecker, our Senior Managing Director for Political Risk, convened a mini panel of our Africa experts.
On the 20th of July, recently elected Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari will visit the White House in Washington, D.C. And then later, at the end of July, President Barack Obama will be heading to Ethiopia and Nairobi. Joining me here in the studio today is Thomas Hansen, our senior analyst for West Africa, and dialing directly from a trip to Nairobi is our analyst for East Africa, Paul Gabriel. Let me first turn to you, Thomas, if I may, about the arrival of recently elected President Buhari to Washington. How big a meeting is this? Is this a game changer for relations between Washington and Abuja?
I would say it is an important meeting, but it is not really a game changer in the sense that it forms part of the natural relations between Nigeria and the U.S. If we look at relations over the last 2 years, they did deteriorate significantly under the former administration, in that Washington, D.C. had lost quite a bit of confidence in the Goodluck Jonathan administration's ability and willingness to really effectively combat Islamist militant group Boko Haram. So I think there's a bit of optimism in Washington with regards to the Buhari administration, and of course they will also discuss counterterrorism cooperation, amongst others. I think some of the other topics that will be on the agenda will be Buhari's new cabinet, which he has not announced yet, but also oil sector reforms. Of course, several oil and gas companies from the U.S. are heavily invested in the oil and gas sector in Nigeria, and there's a significant U.S. commercial interest in the sector. Even though at a strategic level, the significance of Nigerian crude to the U.S. has been in decline over the last year due to the growth in shale production.
Thomas, tell me, how much of the agenda will be taken up by Boko Haram? The relations between Boko Haram and Islamic State have yet to be firmly established, yet this is an issue for stability in broader West Africa. What is the United States' take on the threat from Boko Haram?
Well, the U.S. has been very concerned about the threat from Boko Haram over the last few years. And, of course, the Chibok incident, where more than 270 schoolgirls were abducted in April last year, also really brought Boko Haram to the top of the policy agenda in Washington, D.C. So, of course, it is something that also plays in the American media. Apart from that, I think the U.S. is also concerned about the impact of Boko Haram on Nigerian stability, but more broadly on the impact on the broader Sahel region, including Nigeria's neighboring countries, Niger, Chad, and Cameroon, but also the impact of Boko Haram as a potential distraction to counter-terrorist operations in the wider region.
And as you referred to in your opening remarks, the significance of Nigerian crude oil to the United States is beginning to diminish. Does that mean that Nigeria's status as a partner of the United States will diminish as well?
That has definitely been a concern in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. I think, though, that Nigeria, as the most populous country in sub-Saharan Africa, also has quite a significant market potentially for American companies, will remain a strategic partner. Historically, the U.S. and Nigeria have had a very close relationship.
Thomas Hansen, thank you very much. Paul Gabriel, I'd like to take advantage of your presence on the ground in Kenya right now. Tell us a little bit about what the atmosphere is like in Nairobi. What's the mood in Kenya in the run-up to President Obama's visit? Are people excited?
Yes, I think the majority of Kenyans are very excited. For them, it's like a son coming home, in effect, given Obama's family history. And Nairobi in particular is really buzzing. The roads are being fixed, the pavements are built, streetlights repaired, and all the workers are busy painting street signs and planting bushes along the road. But at the same time, you can also find some critical voices. Indeed, the beautification of Nairobi is applied only to very selected roads, while other parts of the city see none of that. And so when people understand that the city council is able to upgrade parts of the city just for a foreign visit, and then they, of course, ask, well, why can't this be done on a regular basis? Why can't this be the norm? And also in other countries, as we've seen before, Obama's visit, of course, comes with certain obstructions in terms of traffic, access to certain parts of the city will be closed, and changes to the local security environment. And then in the Ethiopian case, we've seen quite a bit of criticism coming from human rights organizations in particular, who see Obama's visit as the wrong signal at a time when civil and political rights are really under severe pressure there.
Paul, Obama's been to a number of other African countries before. Why do you think neither Kenya nor Ethiopia have been on earlier agendas?
Indeed, Obama came most significantly, perhaps, from an East African perspective. He came to Tanzania in 2013. And at the time, that was widely seen as a snub to Kenya. And there are a number of speculations as to why he chose not to go to Kenya earlier. I think some of them hold more credibility than others. One that is, I think, certainly worth mentioning is that the U.S. actually has quite a complicated relationship with both Kenya and Ethiopia. Both countries are certainly critical allies in the fight against terrorism in East Africa, and they're also important growth markets and therefore of interest for U.S. companies. Yet, politically, there are actually quite a number of differences. We've already mentioned the human rights situation in Ethiopia, where following elections in May, the country has basically returned to a one-party state on a national level. And then meanwhile in Kenya, you have issues of corruption, and there are also strong sentiments against homosexuality. You have indeed a number of protests, which will probably take place around Obama's visit, agitating against the sort of his view on homosexuality.
Paul, how will we know that this trip is a success? What sort of metrics are being applied to the presidential visit to East Africa, and what are the goals?
Well, I would say from Obama's perspective, he will probably try to do a mixture of finding cooperation agreements and at the same time reminding both governments of his view on civil and political rights. Now, on the cooperation front, I think he will try to find opportunities for U.S. companies to do business in East Africa, just as he did when he came to Tanzania back in 2013. At the same time, I think the president will also try to get across his view on civil and political rights and where he disagrees with both Kenya and Ethiopia in terms of how they manage those in their respective countries. And of course, both governments here will be keen to be not criticized too much by the president. And we've already seen some measures being put out there to hopefully appease the U.S. president. So, for instance, Ethiopia has just released a number of journalists and bloggers who have been imprisoned on terrorism charges for more than a year.
Paul Gabriel, dialing in directly from Nairobi. Thank you very much and enjoy the rest of your trip.
Before we sign off, a few other items are on our minds for the coming 2 weeks. On Tuesday, July 21st, the Internet Society of China is hosting the annual China Internet Conference. It brings together government officials, industry reps, and researchers to talk about e-commerce, security, intellectual property rights, and other issues. On Monday, July 27th, Turkish and Greek Cypriot leaders are holding UN-monitored reunification talks. And Friday, July 31st, is the deadline for founding members to nominate candidates for the AIIB presidency, noting, of course, that all candidates must be citizens within the Asian region.
Angela, thanks. That's all for this edition of the Risk Map podcast, produced by Control Risks, the global business risk consultancy. Our podcast is released every other Friday on iTunes or via the Control Risks website, www.controlrisks.com. On behalf of my colleagues in 36 offices around the world, this is Jonathan Wood in London saying thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
And from Singapore, this is Angela Mancini saying goodbye for now.